the fifth kind.
Check out our official website at fifthkind.tv.
Welcome to Fifth Kind TV. James Fox is a writer and movie director known for the movies UFOs, 50 Years of Denial, released in 1997, I Know What I Saw, released in 2014, and his latest movie, The Phenomenon, released worldwide just last month and charting around the world.
There are cases that are not explainable in conventional terms.
That have been made by credible observers of relatively incredible things.
When we got right up to it, it lit up.
Was this a warning? Was this an attempt to communicate?
Felt scared.
I was running and playing, and then I saw this maroon color in the sky.
It was not anything from this earth.
He was looking at all of us.
Maybe they're trying to communicate.
They were reaching out to us.
There is an immense array of unanswered questions and an urgent need to get to the bottom of it.
The public has a right to know.
My gosh, look at this thing.
The question is no longer if they are here, but why.
What are they doing? What do they want from us? What are their motivations?
For over 75 years, there have been sightings in the sky.
The UFO shut down several missile silos in Montana.
Thousands of witnesses worldwide.
It had to be a data collection. I'm sure they scanned the warhead.
Just kind of hovering there. It never changed its longitudinal axis. And then it goes poof, and it takes off the side.
And high-level cover-ups.
The government was covering up what happened at Roswell.
Hiding these dark secrets.
I was told there wasn't anything there when I knew there was.
People need to know there is something else out there.
Yes, there have been visitation, crashed craft, material recovered.
Shouldn't we be spending some money to study all these phenomena?
I knew this was breaking news for the front page of the New York Times.
They were trying to communicate, trying to tell us something.
Now it's time to tell people about it.
These things are real. They're here. This is happening now.
James, welcome to Fifth Kind TV.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure. I want to mention one more thing. Out of the Blue. Everyone loves Out of the Blue.
Absolutely.
And it only took me 7 years, so.
Good on you. And the phenomenon has taken you how many years?
Just about eight. From concept to completion, about eight.
8 years. Congratulations on The Phenomenon. I understand it's charting supremely well all around the world, and it is compelling viewing. It's very topical. So much has happened just in the last 3 years in this field, and your movie brings the viewer really right up to date, right up to the minute with what's happening. It's also a great gateway movie for anyone who's new to this topic. This is a movie to share with them because they can go from zero awareness to being overwhelmed with, oh my goodness, my world has just changed. So congratulations on what you've done in The Phenomenon. It is a phenomenon. I want to start where the movie begins, because you begin with some of the change that's happened in the last 3 years. And you begin with the tic-tac encounter of 2004, where USS Nimitz fighter pilots encountered this anomaly. What is so significant about that case? Why did you begin the movie in that place?
Images captured by its pilots of objects exhibiting a vastly superior technology were authentic.
We can start to finally, at long last, after all these decades, begin to answer these questions about the origin of these vehicles, where they're from, how they're made, how they function, and why they're here.
Thank you for that introduction. I felt a couple of things. One is I wanted to put what happened, what was revealed on the front page of the New York Times in context. But at the same time, and that was with an historical perspective, juxtapose encounters from the 40s to encounters that have been verified and legitimized by the U.S. Navy and the Department of Defense, both with Navy pilots' testimony, radar confirmation, visual confirmation, obviously, and of course, the release of official cockpit recordings of the object or objects in some cases. I didn't want the audience right out the gate to think, oh boy, you know, here's another history lesson, you know. So I thought, well, let me open the movie with the most recent revelations so they can know that the audience will know right away. Okay, great. This is about, I want to know more about what I read about on the front page of the New York Times. I mean, that went worldwide. That was a huge story. And I know this because I got contacted from people all around the world. We were 4.5 years into production when it happened. And I knew it was going to be big. And it added a couple of years to the film. But what's significant about it is it was the first, well, first of all, the stamp of legitimacy from the New York Times. And the New York Times, you know, albeit I know its reputation right now is with the current state of affairs is been taken a hit. But you talk to people who write for the New York Times and they'll tell you the due diligence that happens in that organization mm-hmm. is unlike any other news organization on the planet. The amount of verification it took to make that story happen. They needed to hear directly from the people that were involved with ATIP, that secret Pentagon UFO program. They needed to hear from the DOD. They needed to hear from Senator Harry Reid, other witnesses, documentation, Lou Elizondo. It was a very, very lengthy and laborious process for verification. And ultimately what we got is we got this explosive story of a secret UFO Pentagon program when we've been told since 1969, which obviously many people like myself who've been investigating this for decades, that the government is not investigating UFOs since the termination of Project Blue Book. Well, this just throws that right out the water. So the confirmation of this secret UFO Pentagon program, the guy who spearheaded it, former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, I mean, that's one of the second most powerful men in politics. He's a household name. So, and then, of course, the DOD confirming that those videos were legitimate. Those are authentic videos. And then the pilots coming forward and said, yeah, that's what we saw. And I chased it. So it was a very significant event at the end of 2017.
In December of 2017, the lid blew off. At long last, the government was admitting a modern-day program to investigate UFOs and released startling official evidence, including videotapes from the cockpits of military aircraft.
It represents a massive shift in policy towards the UFO phenomenon. The New York Times broke the story, but as you say, it has been confirmed now by US Navy, by the Pentagon. And I mean, who have we heard from? We heard from Eric Davis, the physicist who briefs this secret body that investigates UFO encounters, crash retrievals. That was confirmed by Chris Mellon, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. We had in front Alain Juillet, the former head of French intelligence, confirming all this story. I'm so glad it's in the movie, though, because to my amazement, there are many people who've missed this huge shift that now we're getting official endorsement of the stories that we've been engaging with the UFO phenomenon. I'd like to just pick up on a theme that's in the movie, because your movie charts this shift of policy that moves from denial and silence to now one of drip, 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 endorsement. And the silence, it's a funny story because the silence sort of begins in 1947, number of encounters, and then that leads to some other changes right up to 1969, when the process, the USAF process for reporting encounters was shut down. So it seems that the silence sort of came in stages, but lasted a long time until, well, really, the last couple of years. Why has there been this change, do you think?
Well, first of all, if you look back, starting in the modern UFO era of the 40s, any historian will tell you, you can go to the library's archives and you can look at headlines. There are massive waves of sightings in 47. Headlines. I mean, they're all over America. They were all over. It was making big, big news. They weren't denying it. They were, the Air Force was looking into it legitimately. I mean, like, we're going to get to the bottom of it. That was the birth of the modern day UFO investigations.
And that was their message. They were saying, we're looking into it. When we find out what they are, we'll tell you.
Kind of thing. Then, like, they're looking to see if it's a foreign thing. It was Project Sign, then Project Grudge, then Project Blue Book, you know. And I think right around the time of 1952, when two consecutive weekends in July, when the White House and the Capitol building were buzzed by UFOs, there were military jets scrambled and intercepted a couple of these objects. In fact, in one case was his plane. And it's fascinating to hear the story. If you don't mind, I'll take a moment to tell. But we have very rare testimony from Al Chop, who was in the radar room one of the weekends, the second weekend, when the jet, which they were looking on radar, and the UFOs on radar, and they were listening to the cockpit. I mean, he was communicating with these guys on the ground. He's traveling at 600 miles an hour in the pitch black, pursuing unknowns, when suddenly he's surrounded by them. He's, as you would imagine, you know, he's freaked out. And he radios down to the tower and he says, guys, they're all around me. I'm surrounded. What do I do? And we have this testimony from a guy who was in the room, Al Chop, which is an incredibly rare testimony. We got it from a guy, Tom Tullian. Thank God somebody got Al Chop on camera talking about this. You know, and they just sort of looked at each other and they didn't know what to say. They didn't say anything to the pilot. But Al Chop had talked about the discussions he'd had with the pilot after the fact. And the pilot sort of reminded him, do you have any idea how terrifying that was? There I was in the pitch darkness at 600 miles an hour, suddenly found myself surrounded by unidentifieds. And I think it was right after that when they addressed the nation with General John Sanford on camera. It was the biggest press conference since the ending of World War II, that the Air Force said, okay, we got a problem here. We got to figure this out. It's not like the general public would think of, oh, wow, isn't it fascinating, the philosophical implications of the fact we might not be alone. To the Air Force, it was like, we've got unknowns in the air, flying rings around our fastest jets, penetrating extremely sensitive airspace, and there's nothing we can do to stop it. So they convened the Robertson panel, and the Robertson panel is intellectual heavyweights, scientists and such. And they basically say, hey, adopt this policy of ridicule. And that's what stuck.
Now, you can understand when it gets to 1952 and you've got what is so clearly a national security problem, really an international security problem, that they would feel the pressure to start processing this, not in public, thank you very much. But then it takes another 17 years before they shut down the reporting mechanism. So that's a very interesting lag in the process, I noticed. I wondered if you could speak to that at all.
Well, the Air Force was looking for a way out for a while. The congressional hearings of 66 and eventually culminating with the Condon Committee, that scientific panel of scientists supposed to be outside of the reach of the Air Force. They were going to, you know, basically review the evidence and make a determination one way or another. And the Air Force, of course, got their little grips on there with Condon. You know, the scientists were independent, but Condon was biased going into it. And, of course, they wrote the summary, and the summary was inconsistent with the body of the report. And then it was like case closed kind of thing. And then they closed Project Blue Book and the problem was solved. I mean, it was a problem for them. They wanted out. It wasn't their job.
Yeah. So the Condon report is a really odd moment because, as you say, the conclusion of it, the editorial conclusion was, it's not really worth investigating this any further. But anyone who read the report would have found a significant number of cases through the years that people would have heard about actually authenticated and verified by that report. So a report was published that really showed that something was going on, and yet at the same time it was spun in a way that enabled them to shut it down. So it's a really odd moment, isn't it?
It, you know, I interviewed Peter Sturrock years ago about it at Stanford University, physicist, and he was like, look, man, if the media would have just opened the bloody book, yes, it was a thick book filled with lots of data, and just review the cases. The objective wasn't to find out if all UFO encounters were of extraterrestrial origin or outside, not terrestrial nature, are any. And they found several very credible encounters with multiple eyewitnesses, with photographic evidence, with radar evidence. It's, yeah, you know. But they just, you know, it was written off and they were banking on the fact that we wouldn't do due diligence and we didn't. And that was that.
Yeah. But it's such a shame that there weren't some journalists at the time ready to take the time to read the report and see what was in it. One of the cases that I remember that was in the report, that was authenticated by the report, was some amazing photographic footage that had been captured by a farmer years before. And they are beautiful images of a craft buzzing his farm. This is the Trant family farm.
Well, I got an inside story about that one. Carry on.
No, you tell us. Tell us the inside story.
Oh, man. So, first of all, they were taken in McMinnville, Oregon, 1950. Evelyn Trant was in the garden. They lived in rural, country. And I think the wife saw the object first. And it was hovering not far off the ground. I mean, it was very close. She alerts her husband, Paul. He grabs his camera and he snaps off a couple of shots. Perfect, crystal clear, points of reference. I mean, amazing shots. And they were analyzed and studied to death. There you go. Thank you. And, so I had featured this story in the film, as you know. And I also feature a 1950 Life magazine article about it because, you know, it was newsworthy. And the entertainment lawyer to get E&O insurance said to me, James, I'm going to have to flag this as being a potential higher risk item for your error and emissions broadcast insurance. And I went, this is an article from 1950 in Life magazine, which is now defunct. Really? He's like, yeah, you're either going to have to take the pictures out or you're going to have to find out who shot him. Well, I was like, well, the guy that shot him, that was like, what, 70 years ago? Like, really? Come on, man. And we kind of went back and forth. Finally, I said, all right, I'm going after, I'll figure out what's going on. I eventually get a hold of the photographer's son. This is just like a month or two ago. And I introduced myself. I sent him a copy of the movie. He watches it. He says, these are no problem. I mean, you give credit. Credit's due. And he said, by the way, my father had a really funny side story to this. I said, well, what's that? He goes, well, he was hired by Life to go investigate, made the arrangements to meet with the Trents. And he shows up one afternoon and pulls in the driveway. All the doors and windows are open. Nobody home. He bangs on the door. Hello. He walks around the backside of the building. And he sees Evelyn and Paul in the garden. He says, hi, my name, I'm from Life magazine. I'm here to pick up the photographs and we're going to do the article. And Paul says, I'm sorry, that's just not possible. And the photographer for Life magazine says, well, what do you mean it's not possible? He goes, no, it's not going to happen. He said, well, we made the arrangements. Well, what do you mean what's not going to happen? Why is it not going to happen? He said, because I've got three photographs left on that roll. And the guy said, well, okay, hold on a second. He goes, wait here. He goes to the car. He had a check for $500, which they'd made in advance to arrange in advance. It was a lot of money. A brand new camera, and two rolls of film. So he goes back out to, you know, to the garden, and he says, "Well, look, I as promised, here's the $500, and I've got a brand new camera for you. Plus, I've got two brand new rolls of film." So Paul says, "Well, okay, that works." So he takes the film, gets it processed, and in the film is this his voluptuous wife Evelyn posing in the garden with this big, like, you know, zucchinis and pumpkins and stuff, because there's a local festival that they enter to see who wins the biggest, you know, vegetable. And so there's his wife posing in the garden, you know, scantily dressed, you know, it's just kind of funny, you know, and posing with all these big vegetables. And then all of a sudden there's like photographs of a UFO in the garden.
Wow. That really earns the story.
They weren't out there peddling, trying to sell or get fame or notoriety. Nothing. Like, you know, it was a guy who said, look, these guys were clearly not making this stuff up. I mean, this just, isn't that funny? Little side story. Sorry.
I love how that earths the story. And the footage that was taken of them as a couple, I love that that was captured, because you could see straight away what honest, down-to-earth people these were who had brought this testimony. And it was taken so seriously because of what was captured on film. And even today, the quality of those photographs is really compelling.
Isn't it amazing to listen to her on camera 30, 40 years later before her death?
Oh. Yes, it is. And I think it's very point. There are a few moments in the movie where that happens, where you see the younger person and then the older person. And I think that is very touching emotionally and really adds a dimensionality to what's happening. People who watch this, it's not just information for the head. You will be affected by the movie. And to come away with a feeling of who these people are, who've had these experiences, how they've processed it, what it meant for them, what the implications were. And we'll come back to another story like that a little later. But I want to go back to 1947, because so much was happening in that year.
Yeah.
Very significant incidents. Roswell, of course, being the most famous, Mount Rainier being another. It was the year when President Truman laid the foundations that would enable the classifying of all this years down the track with the National Security Act. Why was so much happening in 1947? And what's your theory behind the sudden spat of UFO appearances at that time?
You know, it's interesting you brought this up, because I, in a very organic way, I had a mountain of archival footage that I got from a gentleman in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by the name of David Marler. He's probably got one of the biggest museums of archive material, audio recordings, newspaper headlines, probably in the public domain, I'm guessing. Huge. And I'm kind of going through and I'm whittling it down to, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. And we spent about 3.5-4 years in the edit room. And a very good co-editor was editing with me, this guy Lance. He said, you know, James, this is interesting. This stuff in Socorro and this White Sands, you know, Holloman Air Force Base and these other accounts here. And we should really get out a map and to kind of take a look at where I put a pin in all these maps, which is what we did. And I'm like, wait a minute. Socorro is only 44 miles by car to Trinity site, which is where they detonated the first atomic bomb in 1945. And then you've got these missile testing range at White Sands. And then the stuff that's happening in Texas, just a stone's throw from over here. And we started looking at this. And then we're going, well, we got Farmington, New Mexico, and this massive flyover in 1950, massive. The whole town, the entire town was standing outside looking up at this armada of UFOs. I don't know why that section of the film didn't end up in there. I had to cut things down. But anyway, we realized that proximity to nuclear activity, atomic activity, and that was when the first bell went off. And I kind of heard about this in the past. You know, obviously this is just speculation, but it's informed speculation. And then The story breaks on the front page of the New York Times right around that time. And I eventually, with the help of George Knapp, get an interview with Senator Harry Reid. And in that, during that interview, he drops a number of bombshells on us, one of which was what we've all suspected in the field. And that is that what's been released is only the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. But to hear it from someone of his stature and credibility, amazing. But another thing he said to me when I was sort of walking and talking for a quick B-roll shot, I said, what was one of the more astonishing aspects of the phenomenon, Senator, that you guys uncovered during the 10-year investigation at the Pentagon? And he said, without hesitation, well, the fact that they're not just seen over super sensitive nuclear weapons facilities, but that in some instances they're shutting our weapons off and very seldom turning them actually on, activating them. He said that was, and he gave it a couple of instances where if the president had called to launch, he couldn't have done it. And I just thought, okay. And then I started thinking about the activity, Socorro and White Sands, Holloman, all around Trinity site, the atomic bunkers, like literally I started piecing the whole thing together. I'm like, okay, let me contact a guy named Robert Hastings, who's the number one researcher on UFOs and nukes probably in the world. He's been researching this stuff for decades. And he made his research and his interviews available to us for this production. And so I started to put together, you know, again, this is organically, and I know there's been books written on it, that the correlation is they seem to be interested in the dawn of our atomic age, to me.
One aspect of the phenomenon that was swept under the rug was the pervasive reporting of UFO intrusions at the world's most sensitive military facilities. Details did not come to light until decades later at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C.
Declassified U.S. government documents and witness testimony from former or retired U.S. military personnel confirm beyond any doubt the reality of ongoing UFO incursions at nuclear weapons sites.
What you have heard here today is evidence of a phenomenon. It sounds fantastic, and it is fantastic. In 1967, I was a missile launch officer stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana.
Malmstrom was America's first line of nuclear defense. Its silos packed with Minuteman missiles, each one nearly 100 times more powerful than the bomb that devastated Hiroshima. Launch officers could, within minutes of confirmation, send their birds arcing 6,000 miles to incinerate key Soviet cities, triggering a war that would end our civilization.
I was the chief of party, I was the observer. Basically, what I was doing was the star observation to provide precise latitude and longitude. On our small three-man team, came from the north and stopped right over us. And it had a white light from the center looking down into the silo. I just said to myself, what if this thing beams us up and takes us off to some distant place and never return to Earth again? I mean, this is going through my head here while this thing's above me. And then from this dead stop, it shoots off to the east. It's just like, now you see it, now you don't.
There clearly is a connection with the nuclear warfare, nuclear warheads, nuclear energy. Just to join some other dots, Chernobyl, you'll probably know when Reactor 4 looked like it was into meltdown in 89, that's right. There was a UFO witnessed by hundreds of people hovering near that reactor. And this was still in the area of the Soviet Union, of course. That was still running at that time. And Pravda, the official newspaper, actually put forward the idea in its reportage of that, the idea that the UFO presence was there somehow to inhibit what was happening, to ensure that it didn't melt down, because we'd have lost a quarter of Europe if that had really gone into meltdown.
You're kidding. I didn't know that.
Absolutely. If it had actually exploded, that would have been the consequence. And so the fact that it didn't was an extraordinary stroke of luck. And Pravda suggested there was a connection with this ET presence inhibiting what was happening. So go to 1989, go to 1951, and there was a movie released called The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yep.
And when that movie was released, I think from that moment on, there was a feeling that this was not just your average, you know, B movie. Well, I say B movie, it was a huge budget to produce that movie. It was a movie with a message connecting the UFO presence with the dangers of nuclear warfare. Of course, 1947 is very close on the heels of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and they weren't the only nuclear detonations. And so putting all that together suggests yes. that some of the presence is here because they're very, very concerned that we might blow ourselves up or blow the planet up. Have you seen more that would unpack that a little further?
Well, I mean, you saw the UFO nuke segment that we feature in the film, right?
It's phenomenal. And a question that raises is, I'm very happy to hear the stories of them turning the missiles off. What about the ones where they flick them on? Did they do that by accident, or is there some odd conflict going on there? How do you read that?
No. I remember Colonel Robert Salas, who was a launch control officer, and he is very familiar with all of these instances. And he said, the message to me is pretty clear. And I said, what's that, Colonel? And he said, it's like taking matches out of the hands of a baby.
Yeah, that's exactly how I read it as well. My way into this whole area of research has actually been through studying world mythologies. And in many of the world mythologies, the first encounter between humanity and an ET presence is a benevolent one where a presence has been established on and around Earth to help us in a time when the future of the planet hung in the balance. And I wonder if that's how our neighbors regarded the world in the aftermath of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and that's why that spat happened.
You know, I can't obviously state any of this as factual in terms of what I'm about to say now, but you know, you wonder sometimes, are we sharing this little space with an unknown other?
Yes. Yes.
The detonation of atomic bombs affecting their dimension, their reality. Obviously, look, you know, these encounters go back millennia. I mean, it's documented on tape paintings. I mean, it's obvious. Why the sudden resurgence in the 1940s? Why suddenly this show of force that happens and is clearly observed? The demonstration, and people say, oh, you know, it's kind of scary. I say, look, the observed technology is so far beyond anything we have that if they were hostile, believe me, we'd know.
Yeah, we would know about it.
We would know about it.
I think that's absolutely right. Just let's take a step back before the movie, because this question of are we alone on the planet is one that you've addressed before. And I wanted to ask, right at the minute, we've got a real acceleration in terms of official disclosures that would get us asking, are we alone in the universe? So we've had what water's been found on planet K2-18b, which is 110 light years away. It's on the moon. It's on Mars. We've got greenhouse gases on Venus. There's this drip, 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 to pardon the pun, of right. information about water and the potential of life in the universe. We've now had these revelations from the US Navy, from the Pentagon. So all that has made what you're doing very, very topical. But long before the phenomenon, you were probing these subjects. And I wondered what it was for you personally that first clued you that we might not be alone in the universe and that we might not be alone on this planet.
You know, I've never felt that I could make any definitive statements as to my personal viewpoints, because it could bring into question the credibility of my work, because my work is based on interviews with high-level military government officials, civilian reports, well-documented, credible UFO encounters. And when you observe them carefully and listen to the testimony and review the evidence, you do the process of elimination, I think, like myself, the audience, the viewer, is going to suddenly find themselves in a place where, you know, it's not the Russians, it's not the Chinese, it's not these other foreign powers, it's not the U.S. What's left? You know, and that's,
yeah,
that's when you have to say, okay, well, these are the options that are left.
Absolutely.
We're probably not alone, but you know, you can't, you know, I'll quickly see a skeptic, and look, I think it's perfectly healthy to be skeptical. I'm very skeptical myself, but when I see people say, one, it's just nothing but anecdotal evidence, I'm like, you have no idea what you're talking about. That's just simply not true. And two, you know, James Fox is screaming from the hilltops, ET is here. I'm like, no, I'm not, actually. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying through the process of elimination, what's left? And you can draw your own conclusions on that one. But when I'm talking to government officials and military witnesses and all these people around the world, I mean, I went to China, Russia, South America, Africa, all over Europe. You know, I mean, you can't help but draw the conclusion on what's left. I mean, we might not be alone. I think it's pretty clear.
I agree. And I must say, I think that is one of the really impressive things about the phenomenon. That's the people that you were able to get to and to have conversations with and to hear these disclosures from. I think it's really powerful, and I really applaud what you've done in terms of bringing those people to a big audience. It's amazing to me what can be shown in the mainstream media and then forgotten, because though the revelations we've talked about are massive, they've been made, and a lot of people are just sort of getting on with their lives as if the world hasn't changed. So I love what you're doing in bringing all this to a very big audience through the movie, The Phenomenon.
Thank Paul, can we add to that for a moment? By the way, thank you. I appreciate hearing that very much. One thing I kind of need to clarify a little, I mean, I get criticized at times because people say, oh, you know, it's rehashed this. And I'm like, well, first of all, I can't change history. So if I'm going to penetrate a much broader, more mainstream audience, which is clearly my objective, because, you know, the UFO community already knows this stuff's going on. Wouldn't it be nice to kind of like, you know, get this out and impact a larger public? I mean, I feel like everyone's entitled to this information. It shouldn't just be a handful of individuals, especially the secrecy aspect of it. And so I have gone to great lengths for the seasoned UFO buffs to sprinkle never before seen archival material, new discoveries on older cases, you know, case in point. With Kenneth Arnold, I interviewed his daughter, Kim Arnold. No one's done that before on camera. Mm. You know, she reveals all these documents that she got and talks about the relationship with her father of the Air Force and showed all these photographs and evidence and stuff that, you know, this relationship went on. He had a correspondence for a while. Nash and Fortenberry, we have William Nash on camera. No one's ever seen an interview with William Nash. That's amazing. Mm. You know, I talked about Al Chop earlier, hearing Al Chop in the room. So we really tried to go out of our way to sprinkle new, exciting testimony, archival material throughout. And also the exploration of the intelligence behind the phenomenon. I mean, I've never done that before. I've never had close encounters of the third kind, coupled with interviews with household politicians. Think about that for a minute. Think about... Yeah. What a slippery slope that was for me as a filmmaker, knowing that they're going to want to sign off on this movie after they see it. And I've got an alleged close encounter of the third kind, a couple of them, one in particular in Africa, where the students are claiming that the beings got out of the craft and interacted with them for roughly 12 minutes telepathically. I mean, think about that for a minute, okay? Yeah. Now these politicians are going to be associated with a film that discusses that. That was a slippery slope. And I was incredibly cautious on my approach to that.
Because and they were happy to sign off on being.
They were happy to sign off, but I was terrified for 2.5 years. I can well imagine.
But I'm so glad you flagged that, because it's very worthwhile people processing what you've just said, that those politicians signed off on being in a movie that was authenticating cases of close encounters that involve close encounters with beings, not just sightings of craft. And that's hugely significant in itself.
I was terrified. And when people say, oh, there's nothing new in this, I'm like, you're missing the whole point. Like, think about what we just did. It's never been done before. And I find that very exciting. I'm not sitting there taking all the credit for it, because I was the driving force behind it. But this movie took a village. And it also takes people like yourself and all the other people in the community to help get the word out. This is not about me. This is not about my film. This is about a larger reality that every man, woman, and child, you know, I hate to have a kumbaya moment here, but it, as far as I can tell, is entitled to. And it's exciting to see the progress that's being made. And it's the result of decades of dedication from the likes of, you know, James McDonald and Stanton Friedman and, you know, Kenneth Arnold. I mean, all the researchers, Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt. I mean, people, look, I could go on all day. But people that have made their contributions, and it's important that we all are in this together and that we understand what we're trying to accomplish.
Somebody I was really happy to see in the movie is Jacques Vallée. Anyone who's seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Jacques Vallée is in that movie as a character. That's how compelling a person he is. And his involvement is so interesting, because there's a moment where he retrieved a document in his work with J. Allen Hynek with regard to Project Blue Book that was a real light bulb moment. And he's also involved right now in investigating metamaterials. That's materials that are from crash retrievals. So he has some really interesting involvement, and he's somebody who is very, very credible. He is a scientist. He is a physicist. He's somebody with huge credibility. I wonder if you could say something about the aspect of his work in the movie.
Well, I have Lee Spiegel, who put the 1978 United Nations event on, which was unprecedented, to thank for that, because Lee brought him to the table. He had a good relationship with him since 1978. And he was noncommittal. He said that he would contemplate being involved with a certain aspect of a story. Excuse me. And that was the Rockefeller Initiative, because Jacques was involved with that.
Yes.
And so that was initially how we kind of lured him in. And then eventually Jacques came out to the studio. And we were editing in this shack that had no electricity. We had to run a wire from the main house in the garden down at the end of a dirt road, no running water, no toilet. And I was a little embarrassed because Jacques Vallée, legendary Jacques, you know. So I had to tell him, I said, Jacques, hang on. Before you come out, I just want you to know that we have this temporary shack that we're editing this film in right now, because I can't really do it at my house. And I have a young son. He's interrupted. We have people coming at all hours. And I couldn't find a place in my little community that was affordable. And so we have this shack. So I said, you need to bring water and food, and you make sure you do all of your business before you go. Jacques came out. What we discovered was this place was so peaceful and so quiet, and there was nothing else to do once you got there than work on the movie. And Jacques was seeing all this incredible archive material, and We'd spent 5 years on Socorro UFO landing case, Socorro, New Mexico, 1964, which was very close to his heart, and I can go into details about that later. And I think that he quickly realized that he had an obligation to assist us in putting the pieces of the puzzle historically together in a way that's never been done before, to be told accurately. And he did. And we became very, very close friends. And he came out on these marathon edit sessions with us. And he would sit in the room and help us put together these stories. No, James, this is not right. No, this is why he did this. And this is the result of how this went down. And then after a year, probably, he said, I need to meet with you. Let's go have lunch. So, of course, I stopped everything. I always go have lunch with Jacques. And Jacques, that's when he told me, he's like, I'm doing something that I didn't tell you about before. I'm doing something kind of quiet with this guy, Gary Nolan, at a lab in Stanford. And I thought, oh, geez, this sounds interesting. He's like, yeah, I think it's time that we can pull back the veil a little bit on this one. I don't want to make any conclusive statements without peer review and publication in a scientific journal. But we can bring you into the lab, we can show you the device, and we can talk about some of the preliminary results that we've had. And obviously, I'm going to take what I can get.
Go ahead. Well, the significance of that is that we're dealing with something objective. It is something that could be peer reviewed. And the fact that we're dealing with physical materials, we are in the realm of science at this point and scientific inquiry. It's not conjecture. It's not rapport. And that's what I thought was so interesting about what Jacques Vallée is doing right now.
This material was manufactured. It's not natural. It's not natural to the materials that we have around us in the lab or on the Earth. It does not mean that it was necessarily made someplace in outer space. It just means that it was manufactured specially for a particular purpose that we don't understand, and we want to understand it.
You know, people have been disappointed because they were like, oh, I wanted to go further. It doesn't go far enough. It's like, well, Jacques is a scientist. Jacques's not going to make any conclusive statements without the process that scientists make, that they do. And that was what they were willing. That's what they were comfortable saying and showing. And there's more coming. That's what I can tell you. Believe me, we'll probably be doing possibly a whole hour on this. But
definitely,
that's just a teaser.
Exactly. In the moment you reflect on it, I think it really is very significant what is shown and the possibilities that are there in front of us. I want to pick up on a couple of things you mentioned there, and one was the Socorro incident. And I was really interested in that from the human perspective of what happened in that encounter. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I got to know Lonnie Zamora's wife, Mary. I got to know his co-workers. I got to know the local sheriff, his daughter Diana, his son Michael. And I went back and forth for 5 years to Socorro. In fact, I bought the family truck, which I have proudly in California, which I've been slowly putting back together again. And I have a very close connection with that family now.
And we should set it up. For people who don't know, we should say who Lonnie Zamora is.
I'll do that. I'm so sorry. Of course. Yeah, I was going on the assumption that people knew about this. So it was a police officer by the name of Lonnie Zamora. It was April 24th, 1964, in Socorro, New Mexico. Socorro is about 44 miles away from Trinity site, where they detonated the first atomic bomb in 1945. Lonnie was on patrol. On duty, he was chasing a speeding car. Something caught his eye. It was about, I think it was around 4:55 p.m. on a Friday. And he's chasing this car down Park Avenue. Something catches his eye off to the right, and he knows there's a dynamite shack up on the hill there. and he thought that, you know, there might have been an explosion, something he needed to go investigate. So he terminates this speeder, who he got off scot-free. I don't know if the speeder saw the UFO or not. And he peels off and he goes up a dirt road and he comes upon, in this arroyo, an object on the ground that was shaped like an egg. And there were two beings, little people, walking around at the base of this object. He's looking at it, and his vehicle is stopped. His window's down. His head is out the window. He's not out of the vehicle yet. And he's just looking at it going, what on earth am I looking at? He was thinking, did a car roll down into the arroyo and a couple of teenagers? And he's looking. He's like, no, that's not it. He didn't know what he was looking at. And all of a sudden, one of the beings turned and looked him straight in the eye. At which point, he decides to drive around and get a closer look, which he does. He pulls up within about 50 feet of this egg-shaped object with four legs sitting in the arroyo. And as he pulls up, he hears a big clunk, like a tank hatch closing, is the way he described it. And he gets out of the vehicle. He doesn't see the beans anymore. And he takes, I think, two or three steps towards this thing, putting him about 35 feet away, which would be, what, 10, 12 meters? And
about 10 meters.
Yeah, about 10 meters. And so he suddenly hears a roar sound and then a blue flame, not like a rocket flame that would hit the ground and then stir up all the dust and rocks. This flame went down and penetrated the ground without disturbing any of the surface, just like a knife through warm butter, right down into the ground. And it was making a roar, and it went straight up to about 20 feet and then stopped and suddenly went completely silent. You could hear, Lonnie, you could hear a pin drop. And he's looking at this thing, and he just doesn't know what he's looking at. And it slowly flies off. And he'd been radioing for the police department to come. And eventually, I think when it was still in the sky off at the distance, the first police officer showed up. And the ground was smoldering. There were four deep imprints from the landing gear. There were footprints from the beans around what looked like might have been a ladder. They don't know. Around the base of wherever these little guys got out. They had white suits on, jumpsuits. And the military arrived, Sergeant Richard T. Holder, within an hour. They roped off the whole area. And he didn't come home. He was interrogated till I think about 1 o'clock in the morning in the local courthouse with the military. And when he came home at about 1 o'clock in the morning, the incident happened at 5 or just before 5 p.m. on a Friday. He got home around, his wife said, the middle of the night. He was white as a ghost. Mm. And she said, where have you been, honey? And he's like, I just had to work late. She goes, well, what do you mean you had to work late? I was working late. You know, he was really, she said he was just terrified. He was just white. And he wouldn't answer her question, and he went to bed. The next morning, she said it was like, you know, a circus of media coverage, and just like it was insane. And the military were coming to the house, and she pulled her husband aside and said, what is going on? And she said, there's something, stuff in the news. It's all over the papers. And he said, well, what you read in the papers is what happened. And that's all he wanted to say. Mm-hmm. And he was going out to the landing site and all this stuff. And, she told me on camera that he was never the same after that. He eventually lost his job at the local being a fire. I think I would want to say within less than a year, he was ridiculed for seeing little green men. And the wife said they were just horrible, horrible. He was subjected to horrible things. And he finally quit, and he went and worked at a dump. And he wanted to be at the dump because he was far away from everybody else and wasn't going to have to talk to anybody ever again about it.
See, I think that's a powerful story because it really shows how ridicule And the fear of ridicule keeps this story underground. I mean, on the one hand, you can have, you know, official policies of secrecy and denial. But the sad thing is that we police each other into silence. And so when somebody comes forward with an account of a close encounter, just stop and think, they're not doing it for their own advantage. It's not going to advantage them. It's not going to help them get a job. It's not going to help them make money. This is the kind of impact that it's had on people over the years. And I found it a very poignant story for that reason. And I'm really glad that you included it. And, you know, to go to his wife now and hear this is the impact of what happened. I think it's really important for people to see that and process that. Another thing, sorry, carry on.
Oh, no, I was going to say that his daughter was in a cut of older cut of the film, Diana. The film was too long and we had to cut certain things, and it just breaks my heart to think about the stuff that ended up on the edit room floor. But his daughter said she did a school project and about his encounter. And he never wanted to talk about it with the family. He didn't want his family to be subjected to what he was subjected to. He didn't want them to have the information that he had, because he just wanted to keep them out of it. Excuse me. He told his daughter that the Air Force told him not to talk about what he saw. One of the aspects of the encounter that was significantly downplayed within Project Blue Book was the fact that there were beings seen at the landing site. Because it's one thing to talk about a potential misidentified aircraft, right? It could have been a lunar lander. It could have been this. It could have been, you know, obviously the technology exhibited at the time in 1964 is just, you know, magic. But still, you know, you could obfuscate enough and kind of get your way around that one. But when you talk about the beings that he saw, these little creatures in white jumpsuits. He said they look like children. He got eye contact with one of them. That was an aspect of the encounter that they downplayed and downplayed and downplayed. But when you go to the National, I went to the National Archives, and I miraculously managed to get my hands on the original files, not microfilm, not prints, original. Like, I was holding my hand, I couldn't believe it. It was amazing moment for me. You can see that the Air Force took it very seriously, the reports of the beings. They took diagrams where the footprints were. Richard T. Holder had detailed diagrams on multiple pages of where the actual footprints were, in reference to where the landing gear was, and, you know, how far out the footprints went, all the measurements, the size of the feet were tiny. You know, they weren't shaped like normal feet. They were more like a hoof, like an animal paw or something. But anyway, it's fascinating. It's the whole, that case is one of the most well, and then of course the Air Force, I've got recordings of Lonnie talking about, he said that they pulled him aside and talked to him for like 5 hours, 6 hours. And they were telling him about all the other sightings in the area that were happening at the time, you know, yes. Holloman and White Sands and Texas and around the atomic area of Trinity site. They confirmed that to him. And they said it's best that you just don't talk about it. You know?
It's often what happens to the witnesses after the encounter that is one of the most authenticating things about the story. And I think Socorro is a case in point. I want to pick up on something you mentioned, because particularly in 2020, there can be a view or a suspicion or a fear that the elites all know what's going on and that the rest of us don't, and that the campaign for disclosure is really operating in that world. So it caught my attention, the role that Rockefeller played in the story. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes. So in the early 90s, Lawrence Spelman Rockefeller was in his twilight years, one of the wealthiest and most influential, you know, families on the planet. decided that he was going to put pressure on President Bill Clinton for government transparency. And in fact, I found out some inside scoop on that because I researched it extensively. I interviewed Marie Boutsy Galbraith, who was involved, Don Berliner, the family. I talked to them a little bit. I talked to Jacques Vallée about this stuff. And I went to the archives. I went to his library. And he basically said to President Clinton, if you don't do this, then I'm going to reveal the fact that you won't do this on every newspaper article. I'll just publish all these things across the states and exposing the fact that you're not going to do this. So kind of like kind of black. Mm. But as it turns out, President Clinton apparently is a very curious guy, and yep. he was happy to kind of look into it. But ultimately, President Clinton says, all right, we'll pick, you know, his administration says, we'll pick a case and we'll go after it. So which case should we pick? Should we go after? And Rockefeller says, well, how about Roswell? And so off they went and dug their teeth into Roswell. And that's one of the reasons why I cover Roswell in the film, where I cover mm-hmm. it, because I figured, well, if we're going to look at, if we're going to mention Roswell, I have to assume that the average audience, if we're successful in, you know, getting into a bigger mainstream media or audience, that I'm going to have to do a snapshot history on Roswell, which we did. And but Clinton administration said they were not happy with the answers they were getting.
The significance of Roswell, for a lot of people, what gives Roswell some purchase in terms of getting our attention and believing that something really significant happened there was the work of Ed Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, who really championed the cause of the Roswell families who had been shushed and silenced, gag orders, death threats, to keep a layer of that story secret. And Ed Mitchell, I think anyone who's seen anything of Ed Mitchell would know that this is a man of absolute honor and integrity. And the fact that he was doing that and championing that, I think,
do you know
was
why?
Very, very significant. Well, I know that he had a lot of first-person connection with families. That was his hometown.
He grew up.
People came.
Exactly.
And they trusted him because he was part of the town.
Yes.
And he said in one speech, you know, having been to the moon and back, they felt I was reliable enough.
Yes.
That they would come and whisper in my ear their own experience.
Yes. Yes.
That is, it's beautiful. I absolutely love Ed Mitchell for doing that. But there's a reason in 2020 as well that it's so compelling and topical, and that's Donald Trump saying on camera on Father's Day that he has classified information about Roswell. And immediately you have to ask, what on earth would be classified from the Roswell story if it's not the folklore, if it's not what the townspeople have been saying all this time? And his son asked him on camera, will you declassify it? And in a moment of thoughtfulness, Donald Trump said, I would have to think about it. And so all of a sudden, our attention is drawn back to Roswell to ask, what is the classified story then?
Well, hang on. You made a very poignant observation, and I just want to go back to Edward real quick, and then we'll get to this other thing.
Yeah, sure.
I was very good friends with Edgar Mitchell. He's been in three of my movies. I went to his home. I loved that man, and I looked up to him so much. He, in the middle of an interview one time at his home, I said, Dr. Mitchell, I'm so sorry to ask this of you, but could you tell me what it was like going to the moon? And I literally, he goes, James, yes, I will. I said, I really appreciate it. So I closed my eyes, as I do a lot of times when I meet with witnesses, and I really want to have their words recreate the experience. I want to feel it. I want to be there, which I did. It was incredible, absolutely incredible. Right down to the time when he shut all systems off, sitting on the surface of the moon, he could hear the macrometeorites pelting the skin of the spacecraft. And the fact that they had been up for 3 days, they were not supposed to go out, they were supposed to get some rest. They couldn't do it. They were so excited. They put their suits on and said, "Screw you, NASA. We're going on the moon. Okay, we're on the moon. We're not going to go to sleep." So they go out there, and then he talks about looking back and seeing an Earthrise, and that the impact that had on his life. And yes. He said, "I held one hand, James, one hand, and I covered up everything I knew, all cultures, beliefs, all borders, countries, everything with one hand." And then he talked about this because he said on the way to the moon, he goes, "I was so caught up in the task at hand, I might as well have been in a simulator. But when all systems shut down and everything was silent and there we were on the lunar surface, that's when it started to hit me." But anyway, when he came back from the moon, he was incredibly famous. I mean, he grew up just outside of Roswell. He was like this iconic figure, right? He walked on the moon. Mm-hmm. So he knew all those ranchers. So when he went back, he told me, they told him, "Yeah, man, that thing wasn't of this earth. You're family to us." And he also had the confirmation within the intelligence agency. So he knew that Roswell happened. And definitely. I was so proud of him. I was so, God, that guy, I cried when he passed. I was devastated. I put him in the movie, just that one little section. Amazing coming from him. Yes, I've used it before. I don't care. I put it in the movie more out of respect to Edgar Mitchell, because you know he knew what effect that would have on his career. Come on, he's talking about pushing for government transparency. He's talking about
definitely.
You know, and I had so much admiration for a man of courage that knew that putting his neck out for the benefit of humanity was more important than the sacrifices of his reputation. So much respect for that man.
I am full of admiration for Ed Mitchell. And when you consider that he would have operated his whole life under layers and layers of official secrets laws, when you see what he was prepared to say in public, I think it's everyone should just watch The Phenomenon and then go and watch everything you can find of Ed Mitchell's, because he was really putting his neck on the block with the way he advocated for his townspeople and advocated for disclosure. Yeah. And when you realize that there's so much he's not allowed to say, and then you see what he did say, then a very significant picture takes shape. I would have loved to have met Ed Mitchell. He's in my book Escaping from Eden, and I spend a lot of time on him in its sequel, because I don't want people to miss what his amazing contribution was, and I want a future generation to know what his amazing contribution was. So I'm so thankful that you included him.
Well, with Trump, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. When I met with Senator Harry Reid, he very nonchalantly, like it was almost like a passing thing, he just said, and it was almost as if he was expecting I wouldn't even notice. It was almost like he was talking to himself, but he wasn't. He said, but the intelligence agencies gave major pushback for the ATIP program. I mean, made significantly pushing back. They wanted nothing to do with this. They didn't want us to do it. You know, it almost ruined people's careers. Like he said, it was incredible, like what happened. And then we started talking about the intelligence agencies. And then he said, well, you know, intelligence agencies keep things from presidents. They do, and particularly President Trump, for obvious reasons. So when I heard Trump say that he was briefed on Roswell or had classified information on Roswell, I'm thinking, well,
who briefed him?
I don't know about that because I know other presidents had looked into it. I know that because I've talked to him. Talked to Ford, I talked to Carter, I talked to all the people around Clinton. If those guys couldn't get access, why are they going to give it to Trump, knowing that Trump probably can't keep a secret? So I don't know about that.
I agree with that, and I certainly don't think it would have been channels.
Yeah.
But by 2020, I think it's perfectly possible that there may be information leaking out one way or another.
I hope so. I really do. And I would love it to be true. I just would be a little, I was like, I don't know about that.
Really? Yeah. That's fair comment. I want to go to the schools that are in the movie, because these are phenomenally moving sections of the film.
In 1994, 3 days of sightings across Zimbabwe culminated in what some believe is the most significant close encounter in modern history.
Hundreds of people today phoned the ZBC and the BBC correspondent in Harare saying they sighted an unidentifying flying object last night. We have some eyewitness reports.
It almost seemed to be under the clouds. As it came past, I noticed there's no noise, and that's when I thought, well, there's something very odd here.
It was quite amazing. It was beautiful.
They are saying that Jesus is passing through Africa. That's what they are saying.
We interviewed about 64 children in front of the camera.
The UFO story that happened.
Just say exactly what you want to say, okay?
Well, I was running and playing, and then I saw this maroon color in the sky.
Shouldn't we be spending some money to study all these phenomena?
I knew this was breaking news for the front page of the New York Times.
They were trying to communicate. Trying to tell us something.
Now it's time to tell people about it.
These things are real. They're here. This is happening now.
James, I could talk to you for hours about this movie. It really is a masterpiece. I'd recommend anybody to see it. Can you let us know where can we go and watch The Phenomenon?
Yes. So glad you asked. You can go to our website, which features all the links, especially internationally, because two things to know. One is it's available, I think, in 12 languages now. It'll be translated more down the road. Two, if you want to rent it, rent it. If you want to buy it, you should get it from iTunes or Vimeo, because you get 3 hours of additional material on top of the 96 minutes of the film itself. So you'd have nearly 5 hours of material to watch. And the website for other links, because it's available all over the bloody place, is www.thephenomenonfilm.com. Thephenomenonfilm.com.
The Fifth Kind. Go to fifthkind.tv for uncensored access to the full revealing interview.